Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, and happy Monday to you. Beautiful, beautiful day here all across the United States of America and around the planet. Well, every day you draw in a breath is a good day, right? Another one goes on. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Albert Einstein: all of us who are concerned for peace and triumph of reason and justice must be keenly aware of how small an influence reason and honest goodwill exert upon events in the political field. Coming up on today's program, Inger Stoll will be dropping by with a little history lesson on consumer activism and corporate public relations. And Vanessa Cirilli from Common Dreams will be here with the best of the rest of the news. We've got some interesting audio on Ned Lamont, Russ Feingold, Howard Dean speaking out about this issue, Barbara Bush weighing in, Ramsey Clark, some thoughts on what should be done about George W. Bush. We'll get into all of that as our day goes on. But first, Dan Gaynor is with us. He's with the Free Market Project. He's the director of the Business and Media Business and Media Institute. Freemarketproject.org is their website. Dan, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be back. How are you doing today, Tom?
I'm just great, Dan, but I'll get better. I hope you all too.
Oh, I hope so too. It's okay. It is a beautiful day here in Washington, so at least that's something.
Marvelous. We have a bicoastal great day. Now, the minimum wage, the real hot potato here, the Republicans suggested that they would be glad to raise the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour if only we could drop about 8 million people from it and attach a tax cut for Paris Hilton and 7,500 other very, very wealthy Americans to it, which the Democrats said, no, ain't going to do that. Your position, I take it, is that the minimum wage in and of itself is just a bad idea, period.
Well, we're seeing right now in Chicago just how bad an idea raising the minimum wage can be. When even the Democratic mayor calls it redlining, because what it does, it forces employers out of areas and costs people jobs. Would a nickel increase do that? Probably not. But when you do what Chicago did, which is almost double the national minimum wage, then the net result is employers go somewhere else, or they're unable to hire, or maybe even have to let people go.
Which is really a variation on what happened after the Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 1947. And, you know, from 1935 to 1947, every state in the United States, if a union was formed, it was essentially a closed shop. And that was the law. And then Taft-Hartley came along and said individual states can opt out of this. You can become a so-called right-to-work state. And a lot of the states in the South said, okay, that's it. You know, we will say unions are optional. And if you have a union shop, you can't force somebody to join that union if they come to work in this place of business. And it makes it a lot harder for employers and for folks to unionize. And the result of that was that labor got cheaper in the South. And some businesses moved to the South. So I'd say you're right, Dan. In a closed system like the United States, if you have individual components of the system that start competing with each other for who can have the cheapest labor, that competition is going to cause economic dislocation. It's going to cause businesses to move around to exploit the labor the cheapest wherever they can get it. But the United States is a closed system, and we're talking about a national minimum wage, and every time since the very first minimum wage, every time the minimum wage has been increased, the consequence has been increased economic growth, not decreased economic growth.
But if you, again, go to national minimum wage, what you're going to end up doing is costing some people their jobs.
That's never happened in the past, Dan.
You know, you're assuming that, you know, and it's all well intended, and this is one of the issues where I think the left and the right, we can argue about this, but I don't feel that, you know, people on the other side of this issue mean badly or, you know, they're trying to hurt people. They are trying to look out for people who aren't earning a lot. But if I'm an employer, let's say, and I have an employee who is doing X amount of work, if you tell me to increase his wage by $2 an hour, you're not necessarily guaranteeing me that his usefulness, what he produces is going to increase by $2 an hour as well. So if it doesn't, he could be no longer cost effective for me, as going up the chain, because if you increase his salary by $2 an hour, you know the people above him, the people above them, et cetera, are all going to expect an increase in salaries. And so if they're not worth that increased cost, well, they're not going to get rid of them.
Yeah, but the bottom, we've just raised two issues here, Dan Gaynor, that I think are, businessandmedia.org, that I think are really worthy of discussing. The first is, do we want to live in a society, we collectively, here we are in the United States, do we want to live in a society where we say, you know, the rules for the game of business, and I'm assuming that you would acknowledge that business is just another game. I mean, it's, you know, I've started seven businesses in my life. I've employed a couple hundred people. It's a game. You know, the way you keep scores with money. It's a game you play to win, you know. But you know, hey.
I wouldn't quite call it a game. I see it's real life. But
well, it's a game in as much as there are rules. There are, you know, it's just like baseball. I mean, there's rules. There's a field on which you play, which is the legal infrastructure of this country. There are rules by which you play. There are rewards if you win. There are penalties if you lose. I mean, you can call it whatever you know. I don't want to get into semantics here, but the point is, do we want to say that if you want to play the game of business, that you have to do it in a way that the people who are working for you can actually, if they put in their 40 hours a week and they work as hard as you know, reasonably well, if they do their job, that they can then, you know, have a decent life in America? Shouldn't we just like say that that's like a given in the United States, that people who play by the rules and work as hard as they can, that they can have a decent life too?
But see, you're, again, working as hard as you can. When I was growing up, working as hard as you can for my father meant working two jobs. He was a firefighter in Baltimore City, and he also worked part-time driving a cab. What you'll find is a lot of people, to work as hard as they can so they can afford those wonderful things in life, work extra. They work more than one job. They find a job they might really want to do. Teachers, for instance, usually work during the summer. They may love teaching, but that doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, there are a lot of people who want to be teachers.
But Dan Gaynor, we have people right now who are working two and three jobs, and they're still not able to maintain a middle-class lifestyle. And I would think that for, representing the so-called conservative point of view, that all about family values, that you would want people to at least have the time to be home with their kids. I mean, you're suggesting that people should work 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and that's just a fine thing. I'm saying no. You know, 40-hour week ought to be enough.
Well, again, I don't know. Working in Washington, I don't know anybody who works that 40-hour week you just talked about.
Well, let's see. I'd even say a 50-hour week ought to be enough. I mean, I don't. You know, I probably work a 70-hour week. But the fact of the matter, my kids are grown up now. But the point is that do we want to be a society where we say, because really this is what it boils down to, Dan Gaynor. First, you know, aside from the fact that if you go back and you look at every year where the minimum wage has been increased. In 1955, in 1956, in 1961, 1963, in 1967, in 1968, in 1974, in 1975, 6 and 7, 76, I can continue on the list. If you look at every single year, what you see is that economic activity actually increased and inflation did not increase. Because all that money goes to people who spend all that money, which increases more demand for goods and services. So there's actually a positive effect, a stimulative effect on the economy of increasing the minimum wage. But setting that aside, because that's something that's unarguable. I mean, the numbers are just there. Setting that aside, shouldn't we as a society say that if an employer wants to play the game of business, they have to play the game of business in a way that allows their employees to have a decent life? And if they have a job that they are so unwilling to say, well, you know, this person is not sufficiently productive to pay more than $2 an hour to, that we should just say, sorry, you know, that's not the kind of business that we want in this country.
Well, that sounds really good, unless, of course, you have to do that for a living. Unless you happen to have that job that you're now just saying, well, we don't want that job in this country. There are a lot of jobs where the employers are paying what they can afford, and there's also a lot of employees that they're paying based on the employee's skills. What you're talking about is impacting the people with the lowest end and harming them. Imagine if you, let's say you've had a sketchy job.
How does raising somebody's pay harm them?
Because if they're not worth it, if an employer will take a gamble on an employee at $5.15 an hour that they may not take or even be able to afford to gamble on at $7.25 an hour.
But that's my point. If they can't afford to pay somebody $7.25 an hour, they have no business being in business.
So you want to, I mean, you just said you had started several businesses. The bulk
yes.
of the economic engine, most of the jobs in this country are generated by small business.
That's right.
A lot of small businesses, particularly early on, go through some very difficult times.
And I've been there.
Just as I say, I've worked at places that don't exist anymore. And some of them...
I've run businesses where I didn't take a salary for 2 years.
Right. And so some of those places don't exist anymore because they paid people too much. So you're just saying they should...
No, it's not because they paid people too much. It's because they had an unviable business model.
Well, some of the cases, it is paying people too much. And that's part of an unviable business model. You make it difficult in small business people, you're going to hurt people in the lowest rung of the ladder.
Okay. Businessandmedia.org. Dan Gaynor, thanks for being with us, Dan.
It's always a pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What did you do right to me, baby? I'll do right to you, too. Got to do under the...
Yeah, that's what the minimum wage is all about. Welcome back, my friends. It's just the Christian thing to do, the Jewish thing to do, the Hindu thing to do, the religious thing to do, the spirit, the right thing to do. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or smalldog.com for all things iPod, Macintosh, etc. Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt. This was back when the Republican Party was when Teddy Roosevelt was trying to turn the Republican Party back into the party of Lincoln, which was a reform party. It started out that way. Then it became corrupted during the Ulysses S. Grant administration in the 1870s, 1880s, and became the party of the robber barons. Teddy Roosevelt tried to take them back. They didn't want to be taken back, so he went off and started the Bull Moose Party. And basically, the Republican Party has been the corrupt party of big business ever since. They've tried to reinvent themselves recently as the party of theocracy and the party of war, but basically the party of big business. I mean, that's their bottom line. And here's Teddy Roosevelt talking about a living wage. He's the first president to actually use the phrase living wage. Not minimum wage, living wage.
For a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
If your wages are subnormal, if you can't make a living, basically, from your wage, okay? So here he continues.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
It varies according to local conditions. Okay. In other words, in different parts of the country, you're going to have different living wages. This is why, for example, here in Oregon, in Portland, we have a living wage law that's actually higher than the minimum wage. The state minimum wage is $7.25.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A normal standard of living. It must include enough to secure a normal standard of living. Now, what does that include, President Roosevelt?
Standard high enough to make morality possible.
High enough so that you don't have to steal to eat. High enough to make morality possible. This is, again, keep in mind, this is the Republican Roosevelt, recorded by Thomas Edison around 1912, 1913.
Provide for
education and recreation. In other words, you can take a vacation once a year. You can put your kids through school.
Care for immature members of the family.
To raise your children. Care for immature members of the family.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness. In other words, what, universal health care? Or at least enough of a wage that you can buy health insurance?
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. Somebody ought to tell the Republicans about what the Republican president, Teddy Roosevelt, said about the living wage. Don't hold your breath, but, you know, it'd be kind of a cool thing. Just, you know, broadly speaking. Okay, this weekend, Ned Lamont, it amazes me how this thing is being spun. First of all, here's on Face the Nation. And, David, who was the interviewer here on Face?
Cheever.
This is Bob Schieffer.
Bob Schieffer.
Even poor Bob Schieffer has started to pick this thing up of referring to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party. It sounds more like rat, as Newt Gingrich pointed out, and it sounds less democratic, as Frank Luntz would say. And so the official name of it is the Democratic Party. It has been ever since Thomas Jefferson founded it, although back then it was the Democratic Republican Party. They dropped Republican from their name around 1830. The Democratic Party, the longest existing party in the history of the United States. And here is Bob Schieffer asking Ned Lamont a question about the Democratic Party. And, and about his candidacy.
On Tuesday, it looked like a pretty good idea to run against the war in a Democrat primary. Then Wednesday...
There. I'm sorry. That is definitely not Bob Schieffer. Hang on, Dave. Who is it?
It's Scott Peely filling in for Bob Schieffer.
Scott Peely. Who the heck is he?
Don't know.
Yeah, a new one. Okay. So we've got some Republican here posing as a newsman and using Tom DeLay language to describe the Democratic Party. But anyhow, here's the clip.
On Tuesday, it looked like a pretty good idea to run against the war in a Democrat primary. Then Wednesday, the plot came up that was revealed of the potential bombing of airliners into the United States. I wonder, with so much difference between Tuesday and Wednesday, are you a man whose time has come and gone?
Yeah, see, the question assumes that Democrats
are weak.
The question assumes that Democrats are weak on defense. Right. I mean, by simply asking Ned Lamont, okay, now there's been a terror alert. Has your time gone? Now, the fact of the matter is, according to all the polls that have been done in the last few months, the majority of Americans say that Democrats will do a better job and can do a better job, and to the extent that they are doing a better job of protecting Americans from terrorist attacks and making America secure and making America safe than Republicans. And yet you've got Republicans posing as phony journalists like this P guy, what's his name? Peely. This Peely guy, suggesting, implied in the question that the Democrat Party ain't no such thing, first of all. This is incredible. This is on Face the Nation. CBS should be ashamed of themselves. Somebody ought to just call up CBS and say, hey, come on, what are you guys doing? What? Implying that because Ned Lamont is a Democrat, his time has come. Well, we'll give you Ned Lamont's response right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Good morning, America. How are you? Don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Lori in Huntington, West Virginia sends me a note. I'd appreciate your opinion about the argument that a raise in minimum wage would mean nothing as long as immigrant workers can be hired far below minimum, and this would further encourage this practice. Yeah, that's the point I've been making all along. The Pew organization just did a study in which they found that the high levels of illegal immigration into the United States since Reagan declared amnesty in 1986, and we essentially stopped enforcing laws against hiring illegal immigrants, have not led to higher unemployment. Nobody, including myself, has ever suggested that it would lead to higher unemployment. What it does is it depresses wages. It just drives down the oil. And it's one of the reasons why the minimum wage there's been no pressure to raise the minimum wage for the last 10 years. Then the Republicans have been able to get away with it is because you've got people who are willing to work for a smaller and smaller amount of money as a way of getting into the labor force. You know, they're kind of entry into the labor force. And which I consider to be not a good thing for a country, not just for the United States, but for any country. I mean, there's a reason why countries have borders, and there's a reason why countries have labor policies. There's a reason why countries have trade policies, which we don't have. There's a reason why countries have national industrial policies, which we no longer have. I mean, all these things that the Bushies, you know, starting with Reagan, that the conservatives have done away with because they think it's all like government stuff, right? It's like socialism. It's like government trying to manage things. Actually, it is. And occasionally, we the people collectively need to manage things. We need to protect ourselves. We may need to make it work for all of ourselves. So anyhow, and then Fred in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT, he makes the note. He says, regarding Dan Gaynor of the worries of raising the minimum wage, he says, I don't get it. The evidence seems universal and complete that raising the minimum wage helps everybody, the poor by giving them a better life, business by increasing sales and stimulating the economy, and everybody else by helping the economy. The argument that it may cost jobs just doesn't hold up to evidence, to history, so why does he oppose it? Well, I can't speak for Dan, and I wouldn't try to. He's not here to defend himself. But I can tell you that some of the conservatives that I've spoken with about this topic simply philosophically are opposed to the minimum wage, period. They don't think there should be any minimum wage, that the business of contracting for labor between one person and another is a private transaction between two people or between a person and a corporation that the government should have no role in. And you could build a case for that. You can, you know, there's a certain appeal to that kind of libertarian perspective of, well, you know, hey, it's between two consenting parties. But where it breaks down is when you look at who has the power. It's the same thing as you know, saying that you know, relations between adults and children should be free of any government interference. Well, I'm sorry, children don't have the same kind of power that adults do, and individuals don't have the same kind of power that corporations do or that businesses do. And that's one of the reasons. And in fact, the only way that they can attain any power, frankly, in the workplace is either through government protection, like the minimum wage, or through unionization. And as we've had a war on the middle class, and on in particular on unions since 1981, declared by President Reagan, we all the more need the protection of government. If you're not going to have the union there protect you, then we the people collectively have to say, okay, these are the rules of the game of business if you're going to play them. But like I said, conservatives don't want to have anything to do with that. I want to get back to this Ned Lamont clip. This is just great. This again, Scott Pelley, Peely or whatever, interviewing him. David tells me he's a regular on 60 Minutes. He, first of all, he refers to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party. So he's using the news speak of Grover Norquist. And then he implies, you know, the assumption built into the question is that Democrats are weak on defense or weak on terrorism, and that a terror attack is going to harm the Democrats. And the fact of the matter is that terror attacks are revealing the Republicans for having decimated America's good standing in the world and put us more at risk for a terrorist attack. But anyhow, here it is. I'll just play this thing straight through.
On Tuesday, it looked like a pretty good idea to run against the war in a Democrat primary. Then Wednesday, the plot came up that was revealed of the potential bombing of airliners into the United States. I wonder, with so much difference between Tuesday and Wednesday, are you a man whose time has come and gone?
No, on the contrary. I don't think our invasion of Iraq has done anything when it comes to the real war on terror.
There you go, Ned Lamont, kicking butt.
Here we are talking about Saddam Hussein, but look what happened. It was a terrorist cell coming out of Pakistan, going through London, threatening the United States of America 5 years later. You know, if nothing else, I think our country's gotten a little bit complacent when it comes to the war on terror right now. Maybe this is a wake-up call. Maybe we'll take into account the 9/11 Commission recommendations when it comes to homeland security, be it the ports, public transportation, airports, nuclear facilities. I think this is the time for America to be vigilant.
There you go. Well said. Very well said. And Russ Feingold, ABC This Week. Again, they asking him, well, what about Joe Lieberman? Aren't you going to support Joe Lieberman? You know, what's the deal here? Here's Russ Feingold, first the question on ABC This Week.
Senator Lieberman thinks that your approach will strengthen the terrorists and it's a victory for terrorists. What's your response?
Well, I like Joe Lieberman, but I support Ned Lamont because Joe is showing with that he doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. The fact is that we were attacked on 9/11 by Al-Qaeda and its affiliates and its sympathizers, not by Saddam Hussein. And unfortunately, Senator Lieberman has supported the Bush administration's disastrous strategic approach of getting us stuck in Iraq instead of focusing on those who've attacked us. I mean, look at the places that have been attacked. India, Morocco, Turkey, Afghanistan, Indonesia, Somalia, Spain, Great Britain. What does this have to do with Iraq?
Yeah. And the simple answer, nothing. And then on Meet the Press, Howard Dean. Again, it's just amazing, the implicit assumptions in so many of these questions. Anyway, here's Howard Dean responding to a question on Meet the Press.
6 years ago, he was the vice presidential choice for your party. What happened?
I think he embraced George Bush's policies and the American...
He, by the way, of course, being Joe Lieberman.
American people are tired of George Bush's policies. They want a new direction in this country, and the voters have spoken. The way to help this country is to limit Republican power. They have failed in the budget. They have failed in Iraq. They have failed with Katrina. I just got back from North Dakota. There's not more than a war on terror going on in this country. There's a war on the middle class going on. You know, those folks need help, and we need help domestically. We need a change in this country. We need a new direction. I think Ned Lamont will give us that new direction.
There you go. Well said, Howard Dean. And thanks for plugging my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War on the Middle Class, which will be coming out in a few weeks. Yes, I know it's a shameless plug, but I thought that was cool. He said there's a war on the middle class, because I've been using that. Now, Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, there was a gig in Washington, D.C. this weekend, and Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, spoke out at that. And here's what he had to say about George W. Bush and his foreign policy.
Because there'll be resistance constantly to the United States. We have made more enemies during the presidency of George Bush and the rest of our history combined. Because you can't beat up on people without making enemies. George Bush has to learn that it's better to feed a child than to kill a child. You make more friends that way.
Yeah, it's very simple. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt called it the good neighbor policy. Jack Kennedy echoed that. Dwight Eisenhower, for that matter, talked about how if we wanted to have peace in the world, we had to make sure that the unmet needs of people were met around the world, that people didn't go to sleep hungry. I mean, the Republican, Dwight Eisenhower, last week or the week before that, I played all those clips of Dwight Eisenhower saying essentially this, all that sort of stuff. And it used to be we all understood this. And then along came Ronald Reagan and, you know, systematically dismantling American democracy with this bizarre notion that Reagan had that government is somehow evil.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, you're going to tell that to the people in New Orleans. Well, actually, see, this is what Republicans do. They break government and then they say, see, it's broken. So let's bring in Blackwater and Bechtel. They can do it and make a profit, and Dick Cheney can have his dividend checks. I mean, isn't that how it's supposed to work? Dividend checks for Dick Cheney? Rebuild Iraq? I'm telling you, if we had taken one-tenth of the money that we have given to Halliburton and given it to Iraqi corporations, if we had taken one-hundredth of the billions of dollars that we have given to Halliburton and given it to Iraqi companies, who originally built Iraq, by the way, every school and hospital in Iraq was built by an Iraqi company, gave it to Iraqi companies and said, here, rebuild your country. The way that we did Japanese and German contractors after World War II, Iraq would be all rebuilt by now, and there would be no insurgency because people would have jobs. But instead, no, we had to go in and make sure that we're paying $150,000 a year to Americans to working for Halliburton, and Halliburton gets to charge you and me that plus their profit, plus a guaranteed profit on top of that. These cost plus no bid contracts. It's a kleptocracy. Why? Because they don't believe in government. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. That's why the Republicans are melting down. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got?
stop till it's gone. It'd be a paradise and put up a fucking line.
And welcome back, my friends, to the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And if you'd like to drop in on to our live chat room, just go to tomhartman.com. You can also find our toll-free number posted there if you need it for reference. However you spell it, it'll get you there, tomhartman.com. And click live chat if you want to drop into the live chat room. Frank in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, back to our topic of the minimum wage. Hey, Frank, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about the minimum wage thing. And first, I want to say, you know, my experience comes from the asphalt paving business, which is pretty labor intensive. But labor is just one portion. I mean, we had fuel, trucks, equipment. Then we had to buy materials, and you have insurance and all that stuff. But I would never, if I had a job that I needed 10 guys on the crew, I would never go with 8 guys because I didn't want to pay the other 2, and I would never go with 12 guys because the guys were willing to work for less money. I don't think any business is going to hire more people than they need or less people than they need to run the business.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really gets me is these conservatives, these people that love Americans so much, they get upset over a wage increase. Why aren't they complaining about the cost of fuel, the cost of insurance?
Because their buddies are making money on that.
That's what I mean.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah, because especially, again, in the asphalt business, the asphalt comes from oil. We need diesel fuel, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the
you guys must be getting whacked by these.
When it's a raise in pay, I mean, oh, that's going to put everybody out of business. It's going to cost people jobs. But if your insurance triples and your fuel bill triples, well, that's okay. That's just market forces. That's supply and demand. It's just it shows where they're coming. They say they love Americans, but they don't love American workers.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said, Frank. Thanks a lot for the call.
All right. Thanks.
And if Lee Raymond, the guy who bears an uncanny resemblance to Mike Myers' character, Fat Bastard, in the Austin Powers movie, Lee Raymond, the former CEO of Exxon, only needs $400 million to retire, so what? But we can't raise the minimum wage, Lee Raymond...
Come here, I'm going to eat you! I'm bigger than you, I'm higher in the food chain!
Lee, get back in your box. 1-866-440-8466. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Rick.
Good show, Tom.
Thank you.
I think you might agree with me when I had questions regarding the coincidence, and it took me a while to figure this out. The day after, or 2 days after, Mr. Lamont defeats Mr. Lieberman in the primary, we have these terrorist plots, which I don't doubt are occurring. You know, there's crazy fools out there that want to harm America and the West. But the timing of this is what makes me suspicious. You know, it's the very day or the day after, and then they arrested some people here in Michigan who supposedly they don't have any proof yet. They're thinking it might have been a worst-case scenario. They wanted to blow up the Mackinac Bridge. But
these guys had 1,000 disposable, prepaid cell phones. And they say that they were trying to make money selling cell phones.
Right.
But I guess... What are you going to do with 1,000 cell phones? You can't blow up a bridge with 1,000 cell phones, but you can make some money selling cell phones. It's just that they happen to be Muslim.
Well, okay. And like I say, I'm not naive enough to think that there aren't Muslims or... you know, whatever that want to harm us. But what gets me is the timing. Right after something goes badly for this administration, there always seems to be something in the news that, even though horrible as it is, it seems to at least be the Republicans, like you say, even they got the news media now even questioning anti-war people. And like you said, Tom, what is so great about this administration? 9/11 happened on their watch. They haven't caught the ringleader. They're bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're talking about going into Iran and Syria. We've still got terrorist incidents occurring all over the world. What exactly have they done that's so great?
Yeah, well, and to your point, Rick, this from MSNBC.com. NBC News, I'm reading here from their report, okay? This is just straight up, no commentary. NBC News has learned that U.S. and British authorities had a significant disagreement over when to move in on the suspects in the alleged plot to bring down transatlantic airliners bound for the United States. A senior British official, knowledgeable about the case, said British police were planning to continue to run surveillance for at least another week to try to obtain more evidence, while American officials pressured them to arrest the suspects sooner. The official spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the case. In contrast to previous reports, the official suggested an attack was not imminent, saying the suspects had not yet purchased any airline tickets. In fact, some did not even have passports yet. The source did say, however, that police believe one UK suspect was ready to conduct a dry run. British authorities had wanted him to let him go forward with part of the plan, but the Americans balked. She had one guy who had got the passport. These guys, they hadn't even bought the chemicals yet. I mean, you know, this guy was going to do the dry run, and the British wanted to follow him. Then they'd have more evidence that they could prosecute him in court. But Bush leaned on them and said, no, you got to get this out. I think this is because Keene and Romer, you know, Thomas Keene, the former governor in New Jersey, the Republican, the head of the 9/11 commission, they just came out with a book last week that says that the Bush administration lied to them repeatedly about the causes and the responses to 9/11.
That's all without precedent.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got that, you know, the book Without Precedent by Keene and Romer, this new book out, which was going to be on all the weekend shows this weekend. It was going to be the big thing. That book was going to be what everybody was talking about. The fact that the Bush administration lied to us about 9/11 and that the 9/11 commission never really got to the facts. That was going to be the big story. And here Bush pressures Blair to bust these guys a week early, even though it may compromise the investigation. And guess what was instead dominating the news stories all weekend? I don't even think this is about Ned Lamont. I think it was about Keene's book, frankly. But the Ned Lamont was a twofer, right? It was a bonus. They could pressure the Blair government to release this thing a week early. And Tony Blair says, hey, yeah, do it. It's for my friend George. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you. Advertising on trial. Inger L. Stoll has written an absolutely brilliant book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. Inger, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is just an absolutely marvelous book. It's just out from the University of Illinois Press. And let's just start at the beginning here. The movement, you talk about in your chapter, The Rise of a Corporate Culture, mm-hmm. the movement that eventually led to the creation of the Food and Drug Administration in what, 1906, 1904, something like that?
That was in 1906.
1906.
Yeah.
Really began in 1892 with Harvey Wiley.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us about that.
Let me just first, you know, tell you how I if that's okay, how
sure.
I became interested in this topic.
Okay.
Really, my book was sort of driven by a concern over, you know, the immense commercialization of media, childhood, and culture in the United States. And I really think it's a very, very unhealthy thing for society to sort of concentrate on having everything for sale: schools, universities, sports, and cultural events, and so on. And people are marinated in commercialization and commercialism today.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually would have been, you know, if this was something that people were very happy with, well, maybe we could, you know, live with it. But people are really concerned. They aren't happy mm-hmm. with advertising.
Mm-hmm. And what you document in the book is that there was a period coming out of the populist and progressive movement in the late 1800s when there was a significant effort to clamp down on both terrible labor practices. Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, really started it with the whole meatpacking expose, but also on the advertising practices that concealed the quality of products or essentially lied to people, and that there were attempts starting, serious legislative attempts starting in the 1930s, to regulate the industry of advertising, and the industry of advertising and public relations in some part having come out of World War One and President Wilson's efforts, did it not, to promote World War One?
Exactly. And that sort of goes back to your first question. The very early sort of first wave of consumer activism in the United States concerned itself with, labeling and foods with labor practices, child labor, sweatshop labor, and so on, and because that was really, at the time when industrialization really, came on the scene quite strongly.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you go sort of continue another 20, 30 years, then the big sort of event is really commercialization and advertising.
Right.
So that was sort of the focus of the second wave of consumer activism. And I think in some ways, and sort of back...
And that was in the 1930s.
In the 1930s, yeah.
Right.
And sort of back to what you said about World War One, I think after World War One was really when advertising took, off completely.
Sure.
And before World War One, people, first of all, they lived in much closer proximity to the product they consumed. They had some kind of quality control. I mean, they knew what went into their cheeses, what kind of clothing they wore, their soaps, a lot of things were sort of made on the farm or at home.
Right.
By the 1930s, most people were dependent upon advertising for most of the products they bought in the marketplace.
They for information about those products.
Pardon?
For information about those products.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And increasingly, advertising did not give them much information. Because what happened was that, the big national chains, the big conglomerates and so on came on the scene, and the advertising that people were increasingly exposed to were brand advertising that basically didn't tell people very much about the products they were, buying.
Right.
It was just, buy brand A and you look like a movie star, buy brand B and, you'll be very sporty looking. Or
right. It was the association. It came out of really a study of psychology. It was the association of identity with brand.
Exactly.
Rather than utility with product.
Exactly.
So instead of buy this brand of cornflakes because they're going to be good for your digestion, which was J.W. Kellogg's original idea.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he actually thought it would be a cure for tuberculosis because it would help the digestive system.
Mm-hmm.
It's buy this brand because that's what homemakers do in the 50s.
Yeah.
The all-American kitchen must have a box of cornflakes kind
right.
of thing. And so in advertising on trial, it's one of the things that I think you've done so well, Ingersoll, with this book is resurrect a memory and that has been lost, has been by and large lost. I would suspect that probably most Americans have no idea that there was a time in the United States when there was a very serious national debate about whether advertising should even be allowed, and or to the extent to which it should be allowed, and the extent to which it should be regulated for truthfulness, and that this produced legislation that preceded the Boland legislation. Certainly, it went back into the early 1930s. The Tugwell bill, wasn't that the first one?
Yes, that was the first draft, and then it became the Wheeler-Lee Amendment by 38, 5 years later. And, so really what you're saying is absolutely, right on. And this is where, people, don't really know much about this period. And many people have sort of assigned to a view of advertising and the presence of advertising and commercial values as something really natural, something all-American, something that really cannot be messed with, something that's sort of handed down from the founding fathers, and that's about it.
Well, in fact, Nike, the year before last, took a case, Caskey versus Nike, to the United States Supreme Court, in which they argued that because they're a person as a corporation, they have the right to lie.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how absurd it's gotten, that they have a First Amendment right of free speech and the right to deceive people, and they were joined in front of the court briefs by CBS, NBC, ABC, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Gannett, you know, which publishes USA Today, General Electric, I mean, AT&T, just a huge, you know, a who's who of the Fortune 500 corporations, because all of these corporations and these news organizations were saying we should have the right to lie, and including in advertising. Although in the case of Nike and Caskey versus Nike specifically, it was around public relations, but the effect is the same. And they ultimately didn't win or lose that case. The Supreme Court ultimately kicked it back to the Superior Court or the District Court in California, and Nike settled out of court. But the question is still in the air.
Yes. No, it's a disgrace. I mean, they really, have quite a nerve to push this issue as far as they're doing.
Yeah.
Because, advertising is a regulated industry. You know, we have a law regulating advertising. But, I mean, if you ask 1,000 people, I think maybe 2 would be aware of it. Just, you can't regulate advertising.
Right.
That's speech, you know?
And not only that, within the regulations of advertising, I have some knowledge of this. I used to own an advertising agency, and I used to teach advertising and marketing.
Yeah.
One of the things that we used to, work with clients on and that I taught when I taught advertising was the difference between benefits and features. The way the good advertising is actually good communication, period. And bad advertising, and I'm talking about morally bad advertising, is advertising that follows the formula that was frankly developed in the late 1930s, which says, you're unhappy, this product will make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
And instead it should be, you have a need, this product will fulfill the need, and here's how.
Exactly.
And there's a real difference between these two types of advertising.
Absolutely, and I think that's why advertisers became so nervous back in the 1930s when consumer advocates demanded two things, basically. First of all, they demanded advertising that was truthful and advertising that provided information. Now, if you are a brand name advertiser, let's say, Lux Soap, and, someone is saying, well, you have to sort of, tell the consumers what's in this product, why they should buy, why it's superior. And, soap is soap, right?
Yeah.
And people then in the 1930s during the Depression would say, wow, I'm paying 20 cents for a cake of Lux when I can go to the, to the grocery store and buy a generic one for 5 cents.
Right.
Why would I do that?
Right. And again, it became a because you're like the rich folks or because you can have
exactly.
The soap. Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
But it's all identification with brand names and in a way, not telling people a lot and in effect.
Yeah.
Sort of keeping them.
A marvelous book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. Inger Stoll, STOLE. Is there a website for this, Inger?
No, just the University of Illinois Press.
Great. Okay, thank you very much. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Did you watch the Sunshine State? How the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate? Jeb Bush winked, I told you so. And the butterfly flew into Palm Beach for Al and Joe got one punch each. 10,000 Gore votes you cast aside before you know. We witness Pat Buchanan's surge while Dems on the voting rolls were purged. Later siphoned off the left. The Reich's lawyers
finish the bed.
And welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our official senior not getting answers correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, Victoria Jones on the line with us from Washington, D.C., Victoria.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, maybe that should be my name every day, but it was just particularly frustrating today in the briefing with Tony Snow, because not only did I not get answers, I mean, I never get answers, you know, I get the dance. But today, I was being referred, you know. I asked a question about this story that's out from NBC that the U.S. wanted to push for arrest in the terror case faster than the U.K. did. And I was asking about, was there pressure put on the British, or were there conversations about this? And I was referred to Fran Townsend, head of Homeland Security in the White House. So then I said that I'd taken an Amtrak train on Friday and the day after the terror arrest, and that there was absolutely no security whatsoever.
Well, this is all smoke and mirrors, Victoria. I mean, this is all about, you know, scare the people and make it look like you're doing something. They're not checking the cargo underneath the planes that people are flying on.
Oh, I suppose you're right.
Pardon my interrupting you with my...
No, it's all right. It's just, I was referred to the Department of Homeland Security when I asked my next question about absolutely no security whatsoever on Amtrak. And as we know, they attack trains in Madrid, they attack trains in Mumbai, and they attack trains in London, and I think elsewhere, and I can't remember where.
Mm-hmm.
So we know trains are a target.
Right, and, oh, I see your point, yeah. So...
And what better place to attack than the corridor, the northeastern corridor between Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
What a perfect target.
Yeah. Well, the NBC report is, NBC is reporting that the Brits wanted to wait another week. And I'm of the opinion, and maybe I'm just a conspiracy nut, but my understanding is that the news shows this weekend, we're going to be talking with Lee Raymond and Tim Romer. Tom Keene and Tim Romer. Thomas Keene, the head of the 9/11 Commission. These guys have a new book out pointing out that the Bush administration lied to them on a whole series of occasions about 9/11.
Lee Hamilton, the coach. I'm mixing him up
with the guy from Exxon.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want to do that, poor thing. And they were, I believe, on Meet the Press. I saw part of the interview. They're polite and they're careful in terms of what they say, but it was pretty damning.
Yes, and this was like, let's push this thing off. Let's push off the Ned Lamont win. Let's get all this stuff off. The news is not good for the Bushies, and so let's speed up the arrest of these guys, even if it means that the Brits are going to end up with less evidence that they can use in court.
It's terrifying if that was the reason. I mean, if that would be the reason why.
But it's absolutely consistent. Tom Ridge, when he left as Director of Homeland Security, on the record said, it was published in USA Today. I mean, you know, he said it on a bunch of talk shows as well. He said that he argued, in fact, against raising the terror alerts all those times that the terror alerts got raised during the election, running up to the election of 2004. He argued against it because there was no reason to, or the evidence was very flimsy, and he was overruled, I guess would be the word, by the White House. He didn't say these were political considerations, but overruled by the White House, that suggests that. It's incredible. And then on Face the Nation, here, Ned Lamont being asked this question by this guy. Just listen to this.
On Tuesday, it looked like a pretty good idea to run against the war in a Democrat primary.
First of all, he doesn't even use the word Democratic. He says Democrat.
Then Wednesday, the plot came up that was revealed of the potential bombing of airliners into the United States. I wonder, with so much difference between Tuesday and Wednesday, are you a man whose time has come and gone?
In other words, the question implies that Democrats are lousy on terrorism. And yet most Americans, 60% of Americans say Democrats would do better than Republicans.
That's what they said in polls before the London terror arrest. I have to say, Tom, that I think that those numbers will have shifted slightly in favor of the Republicans. I know you won't want to hear that, but I do think they will have shifted.
Cheney's out there hyping this thing. I mean, all these guys are out there going, oh, yeah, be afraid. We'll take care of you. Yeah, I think you're right.
But you've got Tom Ridge correcting Cheney.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you for being with us
today.
Thank you. And thanks for asking the tough questions, even if you get referred to Homeland Security. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll try and get some. Anyhow, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, that was a cheap shot. You know, that. In fact, that's a story I don't think ever should have made the press. But that's a whole other thing. Well, actually, I suppose you could argue it should have because he had been using illegal drugs and he got away with it. Yeah. Okay. I'll give you that. See, I just had an argument with myself, and I guess who won? Ramsey Clark, I played this first clip for you. I don't think I played the follow up. Even if I did, it bears repeating. So let me just share with you the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
Because there'll be resistance constantly to the United States. We have made more enemies during the presidency of George Bush and the rest of our history combined. Because you can't beat up on people without making enemies. George Bush has to learn that it's better to feed a child than to kill a child. You make more friends that way.
And I mentioned that, you know, former Republican presidents understood that, as have Democratic presidents. And, you know, it's been the tradition of America. Here's Clark's follow-up on what we need to do about this.
And we, the people of the United States, have the solemn obligation to end this, to end it by doing our duty under the Constitution, to impeach Bush, impeach Cheney, impeach Rumsfeld, remove the war lovers from power, and take the country back for the people. We have the power. It's a question of will. It's you and me. This America is only you and me. We have to believe we can do it, and we shall overcome.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush. Our telephone number toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Our chat room, TomHartman.com, if you'd like to drop in and say hi. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I heard what you just said. Don't feel too bad because I'll back you up. He really does kind of deserve it, Mr. Limbaugh, because, you know, the character of a man is about who he makes fun of. And he's made a career out of it on radio. I've heard him.
Yeah, but my initial take on this is if somebody is taking Viagra, it's none of my damn business.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
You are right about it. But well, you are right about
on the on the other hand, if somebody who got busted with thousands of tablets of OxyContin didn't go to jail the way everybody else, the way that you or I would have gone to jail had we gotten busted with that, if that person has a prescription that doesn't have his name on it, then I guess that is news.
But the thing he's gotten away for years is that, and I want to get to the word progress here but I have to comment on this, if you will. He's gotten away with this for years, making fun of people, good people. Yeah. He should be taking the task for it. I guess I just did.
You just did.
I'm telling you, I like him. There's a lot of personal things I like about him. But as far as his politics and the way he talks about, he calls people names, no.
You're still talking about Rush Limbaugh?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
All righty. Gary, that's not what you called about, was it?
No, I called about Do you think, and I'm being facetious, do you think the tag team of Bush Cheney know what the word progress means?
I don't know where you're going with this. So
okay, I'm going with.
I can't answer what I think is a rhetorical question.
Here's what George Bush said, and I quote, in 1999. I have a vision beyond profit or loss. I have a vision beyond profit or loss. That's what he said.
Okay.
Well, to me, what progress is, and I'll leave you with this, if I may. The true test of progress, it's not mine, the true test of progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It's whether we provide enough for those who have too little.
Yeah. And you're quoting who?
That's what I was going to ask you. I think it's Hubert Humphrey, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. It sounds contemporary. Okay. Gary, thank you very much.
You.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to WPTT there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Marianne in Arcata, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Marianne.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
So I'm glad to talk to you again, and I'm calling about the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard it first on your program there the Monday after, I guess it was July 31st. Anyway, so I printed out HR 5970,
mm-hmm.
at the end of which they attached the increase in the federal minimum wage and tip credit fairness.
Right.
And that's an 8-page deal.
Isn't that weird they call it tip credit fairness? Right now, there are about a dozen states, I'm not sure the exact number, across the United States that require people who hire people who work for tips to also pay them a minimum wage. Here in Oregon, for example, if you work as a waiter or a waitress, you are paid $7.25, which is the state minimum wage, plus you make tips. So you can actually make a decent living as a waiter or a waitress. Gee, what's wrong with that? Well, conservatives don't like that because they want to take us back to the world of Scrooge and Marley. You know, hey, Mr. Scrooge, may I please have a lump of coal? No, you can't. It'll cost me an extra pence. But my son, he needs health care. Forget it. Anyway, they want to take us back to that world. Because they think it was such a wonderful time, you know, the era of the robber barons.
Yeah.
And so they attach this piece of legislation that says those states, these are the states' rights Republicans, right? Those states that have passed laws saying that organizations where establishments where people are paid tips, you have to pay them minimum wage. It doesn't count anymore. Those laws are invalid.
Right.
By federal fiat, they wanted to invalidate state laws, and they call it the tip fairness.
Right. That was the same. Just the same in California right now. The employer is not allowed to offset the tips, and also, so I figured out then this. And your guest, the first guest this morning, he was whining about that the minimum wage would double. Well, that's not true. By June 1st of 2009 is when it at last goes to $7.25.
No, what he was talking about was Chicago. Chicago passed a law. And it looks like Mayor Daley may veto it, but it is passed through the city council that says that any corporation that's over a certain number of square feet, I think it was 60,000-70,000 square feet, and that does more than a certain amount of business, and I think it was $1 billion a year in the state, basically Walmart, right? And this that they have to pay a minimum of $10 and something, $10.11 or whatever, more or less $10 an hour as a minimum wage. And Walmart is saying, okay, you pass that law, Chicago, and we'll move out to the suburbs. We're out of here. And that's probably, and so they're going to try and blackmail Mayor Daley with it. It looks like he's going to roll over and be a wuss. Although we'll see.
Okay.
And anyway, that's what he was talking about.
And so then I figured out how much they would pay in taxes once the minimum wage goes up. And it's not until June of 2009 when it goes to a full $7.25 an hour that they actually cross $5,000 minimum for taxable amounts. And then they would pay $563 if that's all they have, a 40-hour week with minimum wage.
Right.
And
so what we're going to do?
A single person.
So by raising the minimum wage, we're actually going to create more taxpayers
Well, yeah, they would make $15,080 a year and pay $563 in tax. And, you know, that would add up. That would give them a lot more money to pay for the Iraq invasion.
Oh, jeez. Well, there you go. Marianne, thank you very much. Very on point. Very interesting. Larry in Seattle, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. Yeah, you have the opportunity to talk to White House
reporters on occasion. And
well, every day we have talk radio news on here, and they're all accredited White House reporters.
Outstanding. I'd love to hear one of them ask specifically to the president the following question. When you asked Secretary of State, or excuse me, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld about the rules and regulations and laws that control and govern the American finance contractors in Iraq, what was his answer?
Are you sure that Bush ever asked that question?
He said that he would to that young lady that asked him that specific question.
The clip that I played last week. Yeah, he said that he would. You know, Bush says a lot of things. I mean, he's very, very glib. He just, you know, he just kind of, stuff just kind of seems to roll off the top of his head. And I'm not, you know, for example, here's a speech. Now, keep in mind, on 9/11, none of us saw the first plane hit the first tower until more than a day later, because there were no cameras. There was a tourist camera. It didn't show up, an Italian tourist. It showed up the next day. So the morning of 9/11, nobody was watching the first tower. We all saw the second tower hit. Here's Bush.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And
here comes the lie.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And said it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. And I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
See, he just makes stuff up, you know, whatever works for him at the moment. So, no, I have no faith at all that he actually asked Rob.
I'd just love himself to hear him pinned to the wall on that one, since he specifically said he would.
Yeah. Me too, Larry. I don't think it's going to happen, but I'll pass it along.
Thanks a lot.
Good talking with you. Thanks for calling. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's just time to pay the price. Not listening to advice. Deciding in your youth on the policy of truth.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least one good set of clean elections. You know, we'd really settle for that. What can I say? And that, it'd be a great start, wouldn't it? Just a great start. Oh, my. 9 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Brian in Manchester, Vermont, listening on WVAA. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to say I agree with you about the elections. I'm praying to all gods for that to come about 2006 in November. But I wanted to talk about, you had Ramsey Clark with a quote from him on earlier this hour. I think that's a perfect lead in where I've gotten to a website, defenseindustrydaily.com. Mm-hmm. It talks about the whole direction of our national defense, I would call it offense now, terrorist creation industry, is totally to benefit defense contractors, offensive contractors, and the war profiteers. It's something our founding fathers were dead set against, obviously. But I'm also looking at talking about the blowback, you know, with this plot that was uncovered by the British police and not by the British Army in the United Kingdom, the recent plot there. It was kind of like the Bojanka plot over the Pacific in 1995 that was uncovered. Mm-hmm. But now we're seeing, though, Vladimir Putin's proposed a 22% increase for the Russian 2006 defense budget.
Yep.
China's stepped up its defense expenditures, and we can't even properly, even after that big expose where the soldier asked Rumsfeld about up-armoring the Humvees. They just showed a contract for up-armoring, about $600 million contract. And the prices, it's going to be completed by December 31st, 2007, but our exhausted army is now going back into Baghdad to help the Iraqi army and security forces try to apply some kind of security to the civil war, what they call sectarian violence. And this is totally mismanaged. It just, they don't care. They just don't care about...
Actually, I think they do care, Brian. I think that they care...
about profits?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And frankly, I think when Cheney said that this thing was going to, you know, be a cakewalk, when Rumsfeld said it was going to last 6 weeks at the most, or it was 6 months, whatever it was, that I think they believed it. These guys have a capacity for self. See, none of them had been in a war.
Yeah, they definitely.
These guys are all chicken hawks. The only one of them who'd been in a war was Colin Powell, and Colin Powell was warning against it.
Like Eric Witowski said, they hadn't even sampled barracks life, and even in their Army Reserve or anything like that. Nothing.
That's right. Yeah.
But Tom, I was also going to ask. Also, we could, for a stopgap measure, I'm going over the reform plan of Republic of Korea, South Korea's defense reform plan, and they're fully able to take care of themselves. Again, the North Koreans don't really want to attack them. They release some rhetoric. They want to attack America and Japan, maybe. But we could still transfer some more troops from Korea, I would say. But also in their defense, the reform plan, it's the National Defense Research Institute by the RAND Corporation. Do you know, is that related to the Enron Objectivist?
No, completely different.
Completely different, okay. But I'm just thinking as a stopgap measure that there's something to help our exhausted kids over there in Iraq. God love them.
Well, the thing to do to help them, Brian, is to get them out of there. It's really simple. And thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It's just, you know, time to pull them out. I'm sorry. And I think that Joe Biden is right, that it is time to partition the country, because we've scrambled this thing so badly. Keep in mind, Iraq was three countries, or it was three states in the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years. And those three states were arbitrarily cobbled together in 1919, after World War I, by the British, by and large, and formed into Iraq. And it used to be a Shia area, a Sunni area, and a Kurdish area. And you know, Kurdistan got broken up into three. You know, part of it's in Turkey now, and part of it's in Iraq, and a little bit of it, I guess, is in Iran. And this used to be three separate states, and I suspect that's going to be the only solution, is the Balkanization of this, you know, to do it like we did with Yugoslavia and take it back apart. Now, in response to your question about profits, consider, if George W. Bush had responded to 9/11 the way Bill Clinton responded to Tim McVeigh blowing up the federal building, and Tim McVeigh was trying to do the exact same thing Osama bin Laden was, by the way. Tim McVeigh wanted Clinton to overreact and declare a war on Christian fundamentalism. He had read this book, The Turner Diaries, and he really and truly believed that he could get it, because this is what happens in The Turner Diaries. In this novel that the survivalists are all into, a good guy survivalist blows up a federal building. The feds hyperreact by turning the United States into an Orwellian 1984 state and clamping down, and all the good white Protestant Christians rise up and kill off all the people of color, all the Jews, and all the Catholics. And in the end, the only people left standing are the good white Protestant evangelicals. And Tim McVeigh was one of them, and he really and truly believed that's what would happen. And instead, Bill Clinton responded to it by saying, this guy is a criminal, and we're going to track him down as a criminal, and we're going to deal with him in the criminal justice system. And we got closure, and McVeigh is gone. Now, just imagine if Bush had said, okay, bin Laden is a criminal. If there's evidence he committed this crime, let's put that evidence before a court of law. The Taliban offered to hand bin Laden off to third-party country for trial. We could have had a trial. We could have shut down the camp. We could have said, that's it. And al-Qaeda would have been totally discredited. Keep in mind, the day after 9/11, people were marching in the streets of Tehran, candlelight vigils, in support of the United States. The entire Islamic world was offended by what bin Laden had done. He had overreached. They were horrified. If Bush had handled this thing the way that Clinton handled McVeigh, if he had handled bin Laden the same way, bin Laden would be sitting in jail right now. He wouldn't be anybody's martyr. He wouldn't be anybody's hero. He'd be viewed as a crackpot. You wouldn't have suicide bombing. But the problem is, the Carlyle Group and Bush's daddy wouldn't have made billions of dollars. Halliburton wouldn't have been, you know, Halliburton, keep in mind, was losing money when Dick Cheney became vice president. They're very profitable right now. They had a loss in 2000. Halliburton wouldn't be making money. Bechtel wouldn't be making money. Blackwater wouldn't be. It just wouldn't have worked out quite so well for Bush's buddies. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance, not a chance. Oh, man. Yeah.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, I just now got my email from the GOP USA. GOP USA Eagle, Bobby Eberle at GOPUSA.com. And this, the one of the email things that goes out to all the Republicans. Those of you who are new listeners, just so you know, because someday it'll probably come out, might as well just tell you right up front. Every year I send $5 to the Republican National Committee, and so that I get on their list and I get all their stuff, and they spend $20 sending me junk, which I think is a pretty good return on investment, frankly. And plus, you know, I get all the emails as a talk show host. They just assume that you're a right-wing talk show host if you're a talk show host, and so I get all this stuff from them. From other divisions, I get personal emails from George W. Bush. Yeah, right. But that's what it says. In any case, this is, you know, bringing the conservative message to America is the headline on the Eagle from GOP USA, GOPUSA.com, the website. And I just got my newsletter, Doug Patton writing the column. The headline, Why I Would Vote for Joe Lieberman. He says, I have often said that I fully embody Winston Churchill's adage that any 20-year-old who is not a liberal has no heart, while any 40-year-old who is not a conservative has no brain. Having come to my senses long before I turned 40, and having passed that milestone some time ago, it has been a long time since I voted for a Democrat for anything. That said, if I lived in the state of Connecticut, I would vote to return Joe Lieberman to the United States Senate. Say what? The Republicans are now sending out a message to their base saying vote for Joe Lieberman. Thus, the most recent poll has Lieberman beating Lamont 56-51, was it? No, 46-41. It must be. And the Republican only has 6% of the vote. I'm telling you, there's more than 6% of the voters who are Republicans in Connecticut, even in Connecticut. What's going to be really interesting is if Lieberman gets elected as an independent, whether he will then choose to caucus with the Democrats as he said he will. Because you go back and you look at his voting record, and he is conservative on some issues, but he's also not that bad a Democrat, frankly. I mean, he's kind of a middle of the road. He's sort of a Joe Biden Democrat. Yeah, I'm not horribly offended by him as a Democrat, other than his stand on the war. He's not the very best on everything. But last week or 2 weeks ago, we went through Joe Biden's Joe Lieberman's voting record step by step, and it's not terrible. It's not great. I mean, you know, he's not my idea of a progressive. He's certainly not a progressive. But is he suddenly going to do a Zell Miller and go screeching to the right because the Republicans are going to help him get back into power? Has he already cut a deal with them to do that? Are they just expecting him to do that because that's what happens with folks like Zell Miller? Don't know. Oh, we'll just have to see how it shakes out. In the meantime, time for a China alert, I think. It's time to learn Chinese. Xi. This is from the Wall Street Journal. China's latest record trade surplus is fueling concerns over whether its government has the tools to reduce the imbalance. Actually, all we'd have to do is just go back to a tariff-based international trade policy here in the United States so we could solve the problem for China. But the July surplus, writes Andrew Beetson in the Wall Street Journal, the July surplus, the third consecutive record in as many months, was driven by a 23% jump in exports from a year earlier. 23%! Now on track to reach an unprecedented $150 billion or so in 2006. I actually love this music. It's from a Chinese opera I visited in Beijing. Her husband's a seer, her boyfriend. Anyway, here the effects of such an appreciation. They talk about many politicians and economists argue the sharp strengthening of China's currency is what needed. It's what's needed, right? This is what the Bushies are. They're running around going, ah, China, their dollar or their yuan is what it's called. The yuan is too cheap. And that makes Chinese goods cheaper in the United States, so they should strengthen their currency. Well, Bateson writes in the Wall Street Journal, you might have just the opposite effect if you do that. He writes, however, the effects of such an appreciation, an increase in the value of the Chinese currency, might not be so easy to predict. In part because of the unique nature of China's trade, the majority of its exports... Now, here's where it gets amazing. Consider, before I read you the sentence, let me just lay this on you. Between a quarter and a half, depending on whose figures you're using and depending on how it's calculated, between a quarter and a half of all trade in the world, all international trade in the world, is intra-company. In other words, Sony manufactures something in China. They sell it to Sony in Japan. Sony in Japan ships it to the United States and sells it in a let's say it's a DVD, which, you know, is Sony Entertainment in the United States, and they sell it in a store that's owned by Sony in the United States, or they sell it through a distribution channel that's owned by Sony in the United States. So you have Sony selling to Sony, selling to Sony, selling to you. But along the way, it went from China to Japan to the United States. Now, is that international trade or is that Sony trade? And I'm not picking on Sony. I mean, you could, you know, pick your company. So somewhere between a quarter and a half, depending on how you calculate it, because in some cases a company is dealing with a division of itself and that's considered another company. But somewhere between a quarter and a half of all trade in the world is intra-company. That is a company selling to itself. This is why the Bush administration policy, and really it was the Clinton, it was Bill Clinton who started this. Well, it wasn't Bill Clinton who started it. It was Ronald Reagan who started it. And arguably, it went back to Nixon. Nixon first started asking for it. It was Reagan who started pushing for it seriously. It was Bush Sr., his whole thing about fast-track authority and the New World Order that really got it going. He campaigned hard for it. Ross Perot came out because both Clinton and Bush were saying, no, we need to have international trade, you know, NAFTA and GATT and all this stuff where the corporations get to make all the rules and screw the countries. Doesn't matter what the people want. It matters what the big corporate donors want because they're actually supporting the Republicans and Democrats, or at least they were back in 1992. And so Ross Perot comes out and, you know, with his big ears and his charts and his graphs, and they make cartoons out of him, but the guy was right. He says, this is going to be a disaster if we go away from a tariff-based policy, a tariff-based trade policy, and go toward a so-called free trade policy. The tariff-based policy used to be, if you make a pair of shoes in the United States and there's a dollar's worth of labor in those shoes, and you want to make those shoes in China, that's fine, you can make them there, where there's 10 cents worth of labor in a pair of shoes. But when you import them into the United States, you have to pay a 90-cent tax on them. It's called a tariff. So that it costs you a dollar, regardless of where you make them, to make up for the cost of labor. And that's how we kept making shoes in the United States from 1776 right up until about 10 years ago. And now, you know, we've done away with all of our tariffs for all practical purposes, and it's all these corporations doing business with themselves. And that's why they're shipping their jobs overseas. So back to this sentence from the Wall Street Journal, headline, China's trade surplus swells to third consecutive record. The effects of raising Chinese currency may not be so easy to predict why the majority of its exports actually come from companies backed by foreign investors. Having decided to do their manufacturing in China, they might not respond quickly to shorter-term policy changes. As Ku Hongbing, an economist with HSBC, said, China's trade surplus is more a reflection of the continued reallocation of global manufacturing to China rather than an intentional policy. In fact, they go on to point out a rise in the currency might actually lower exporters' costs, which means it would make the trade imbalance even worse because the companies here own the factories there, or a good chunk of them. So, you know, raising the value of the currency, they're going to be more profitable in their Chinese operations. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jerry in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, a little while ago, the Supreme Court turned the eminent domain historical standards as far as, you know, private property goes on its head. And
you're talking about the Kelo decision?
Yes.
Yeah.
And apparently, Governor Norquist has got an initiative, 50 statewide initiative program going, hoping to capitalize on the anger that people feel about, you know, commercial enterprises basically using local mayors and city councils and that kind of thing as a shield to get their hands on property that people don't want to sell.
Right.
To get people to sign up for initiatives, it's an initiative program that basically would overturn environmental bans to eminent domain and you know, or anything that is restricting the use of private property by individuals, getting people to sign on for overturning all of those.
Well, hang on just a second here. Jerry, maybe you can educate me about this, because there is, in fact, I interviewed the guy, I believe it was Don McIntyre, who got this thing on the ballot here in Oregon. This is there one of these initiatives, and I knew that his money was coming from Norquist and buddies.
Yeah.
And he represented it to me as being just, we're going to say the Kelo decision doesn't apply here. Now for those listeners who don't know what Kelo is, the Fifth Amendment of the United States says that the federal government shall not take your property without justly and appropriately compensating you, and may only do so for public purposes.
For public good.
And how that's been interpreted is the public good is things like, we need to build a fire station, we need to build a school, we're going to put a road through here, so we're going to take your house whether you like it or not, because the public good is going to be served, but you have to be justly compensated. Now,
right.
In the Kelo decision, They concluded that you had this town in Connecticut, as I recall, that had a part of town where it wasn't doing all that well economically, and they said, okay, if we tear down these people's houses and we put in a big fancy shopping mall or a casino or whatever it was,
a Walmart,
whatever, it's going to make a whole lot more money, it's going to pay a whole lot more taxes, and because it pays more taxes, that's going to benefit the public good. And the Supreme Court ruled, yep, that's the case. So now, the government, you know, now local, state, county, municipal, all the way up to federal governments, now governments have the right to take private property, you are my private property, and sell it to other private property owners rather than to use it just for government purposes, simply to increase the tax base. And
probably never would be their buddies either.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah. And so Norquist, now this is something, this is a decision that has sparked indignation right across the political spectrum. I'm as upset about it as Grover Norquist is. But the conservatives were smart enough, at least this is how it looked to me, Jerry, the conservatives were smart enough to get out in front of the issue and say, we're going to champion the people's cause on this thing, and we're going to get ballot initiatives in all the states where it's legal to have direct democracy, have ballot initiatives. We're going to have ballot initiatives saying, you can't do that in this state. And as I said, when I interviewed the guy who got the ballot initiative on the ballot here in Oregon, you know, I said, are there any gotchas in here? Are you messing with the law, any other laws, or is this simply say that you can't take private property to sell to other private corporations? And he said, that's all it says. Now, I haven't read the ballot initiative. You're telling me it goes beyond that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that particular ballot initiative, but what I'm hearing from political hacks in this area, and I've been, you know, I got friends, basically, that are mm-hmm. been involved in the process for years and years and years. But what they're saying is underfoot is legislators are being talked to about the possibility of throwing their support and behind initiative efforts in their districts that would basically capitalize on the anger that was produced by this decision to get people to say, well, you know, I don't want government messing around with the use of my property for environmental reasons or any other thing.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
Zoning standards.
Right. What you're talking about in Washington State is what has already happened here in Oregon. It happened here last year in Oregon. It's called Measure 37 here in Oregon. And what it says is if you owned property and there were no environmental restrictions, and then they came along and discovered that there was, you know, wetlands down the street or something, and you can no longer develop that property, and so the value of the property has not gone up, the government has two choices. They can either compensate you for the loss of value as the result of these new laws, these new rules, or they can waive the rules. But then they didn't put any funding into the law whatsoever, which means that basically it blows all the zoning laws, all the environmental laws, everything else out. Yeah, there's a big editorial about it in today's Oregonian, in fact. You can read it online at OregonLive.com. And it's called Measure 37. And they sold this thing last year here, 2 years ago, on the ballot with Granny saying, my house isn't worth as much as it used to be, and I'm being screwed.
It's horrible.
Yeah. And now they're doing this in states all across the United States. This has got nothing to do with Kelo, you're right. It's got nothing to do with the Kelo decision.
No, they're just trying to take advantage of the sentiment that's Kelo produced.
You're right, Jerry. It's already happened here in Oregon, and it's a terrible thing, and it's coming to a town near you. It's apparently on its way to Washington. Jerry, thanks for the heads up. And, you know, I think between the two of us, we've probably informed a few people about it. Look out, my friends. This is not something you want in your state. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't know, y'all. We in the real tough position. In the midst of all these negative conditions, divided by beliefs, differences in religion. Why do we keep missing the point on our mission? Why are we killing each other? What's the reason? God made us all equal in his vision. I wish that I could make music as a religion. Then we could harmonize together in this mission. Listen, I know it's really hard to make changes, but two of us can help and rearrange this. Cause utilize our power and our voices. Together we will unite and make the right choice and fight for education. Save the next generation. Come together as one. I don't understand why it's never been done. So let's change on the count of one.
It takes one, just one. And then one falls, get the one. And then the other falls, another one. Next thing you know, you got a billion.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. 889 days, 10 hours, 24 minutes, 22 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. It may happen a little sooner if the Democrats get elected to the House and Senate, take control of those two bodies, and John Conyers House Resolution 635 comes forward for a vote, the impeachment resolution. In the meantime, let's take a look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire.
following our security incidents in Iraq. As of Monday, 0900 GMT, reported by Reuters, Dateline Baghdad, four Australian soldiers were hurt in a rocket attack in the Green Zone. Near Khalis, two civilians were killed and three others wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their car in the village near that town. In Baghdad, the death toll from multiple attacks in the Shiite Zarafarina district of Baghdad overnight on Sunday has risen to at least 56, with 128 wounded. Simultaneous attacks included a suicide motorcycle bomber, rockets, and a roadside bomb. In Tal Afar, eight civilians were wounded when a mortar round landed in the town of Tal Afar. In Baghdad, two car bombs exploded simultaneously in eastern Baghdad, killing two people and wounding four. Near Hawija, the body of a man was found in a village near Hawija. In Baghdad, a civilian was killed and three others wounded when a car bomb exploded in central Karada district of Baghdad. In Fallujah, gunmen killed a civilian. In Mosul, gunmen killed three civilians. In Fallujah, gunmen kidnapped the son of a tribal leader. In Mosul, gunmen killed a tribal leader and wounded his son in that city. Near Baquba, a roadside bomb exploded next to a bus carrying police recruits escorted by U.S. patrol, killing one recruit and wounding 10. In Tal Afar, nine Iraqi soldiers were wounded on Sunday night by a suicide car bomb near a checkpoint in that city. And in Mosul, gunmen killed a civilian on Sunday in that northern city. Property developer named Abdel Salomon was shot and wounded in a separate attack. TomHartmann.com, our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, say hi. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in. And Carol in Olympia, Washington, on the line. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. I wanted to comment on a story you were talking about a few minutes ago about international trade.
Yeah.
And you were saying that I think it was 25 or 30% of all of the trade actually is in-company trade.
Yeah, 25 to 50%, depending on how you...
50%.
Yeah. Depending on whose numbers you're using and how it's calculated.
Right.
For example, right. Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root, are they two companies or one?
Right, exactly. No, it's a very, very complicated situation, and I hadn't heard you say 50%. I think that's probably closer to the mark.
Yeah.
It seems to me that I guess the comment that I've, or the thing that I've thought about for a long time is that, you know, we use the word trade and free trade, but I don't think what all of this is really trade at all. When you have companies, American companies, that relocate, that put their factories in other countries and then import goods made overseas, you know, that's considered trade. But the ownership, you were talking about investment-backed companies and all that, it's very difficult to sort of follow the money, you know.
Yeah, no, this is colonialism. Imperialism is not quite the right word, but it's
something like that.
Yeah,
I completely agree. That's
what it's the British East India Company used to do.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's why the world is reacting to it the way that we reacted to the British East India Company in 1773 when we tossed their tea in the harbor.
Yes, exactly. I completely agree, and I think we have a real problem with framing, you know, once again. The way we use our terms is very misleading.
Yeah.
We're basically exporting all of our pollution problems and our, you know, we've broken the unions. I mean, all of these consequences, you know, are taking place.
In my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, I make the point that we haven't, you know, talking about slavery during the time of Jefferson and Jefferson's positions on slavery and how he tried to end slavery. He thought he actually got it written into the Constitution that slavery would be ended by, you know, 1808, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And in his last days, he was just in agony about slavery and writing about how it was going to be the end of the Republic and predicting the Civil War and the whole thing. And then I wrap that chapter up by pointing out that we haven't ended slavery in the United States. We've merely exported it.
Right.
We don't look our slaves in the face the way Jefferson did. Our slaves are now in China.
Exactly, exactly. So. And the pollution over there is absolutely horrendous, and the people dying there.
Yep.
Well, thank you. That was my point, and I'll have to read your book.
Okay,
great.
Okay. Carol, thanks a lot. Thanks
thank
a lot
you,
for the call.
Okay.
Nice to hear from you. Jimmy in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Jimmy, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about Thomas Jefferson's attitude towards hemp.
Okay.
Okay. He grew it himself on his plantations. He smuggled.
Perhaps we know that Washington did. I don't know if Jefferson did.
Yes,
or not.
He smuggled rare seed varieties out of China when it was a capital offense.
Hmm.
And he wrote a letter saying that basically saying that Southern farmers should give up growing tobacco and grow hemp instead, because the language was a little different then. He didn't really, you know, they didn't really understand addiction at the time. Mm-hmm. But if they had, they would have said tobacco only has value because of its addictive qualities. But what he said was caprice and and he also, I'm trying to find it. I've got a letter.
It's interesting. I'm looking at the collected works of Jefferson right now. Tobacco, from his notes on Virginia, tobacco, hemp, flax, and cotton are our staple commodities.
Yes, strategic.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Even strategic.
Wool, flax, and hemp are very close, unsightly, and unpleasant. He's talking about the flaxseed hemp, 8,000 pounds. This is, I'm getting a lot of hits on the word hemp here when I'm looking through his combined writing. Anyhow, what's your point there, Jimmy?
Okay.
I'm not seeing anything here. We know that the Constitution, for example, was written on hemp paper.
Yes.
And that these guys used this to make rope. I've read a lot of Jefferson's writings, and I can't say that I've read all of them, but I've never seen anything that would indicate that he used it as a drug.
Okay, but here's
it is. Hemp, on the other hand, is abundantly productive and will grow forever on the same spot.
Yes.
The breaking and beating it, which has always been done by hand, is so slow and so laborious and so much complained of by our laborers that I have given up and purchased and manufactured cotton for their shirting. So,
have you ever heard of a book called Hemp and the Marijuana Conspiracy called The Emperor Wears No Clothes? It talks about, there was some technological breakthroughs in the mid-30s that would have spread hemp culture much more.
Yeah, well, the main thing was the cotton industry was behind the criminalization of marijuana in the 1930s. I mean, that was
that's the thing, is that was used as an excuse.
Yeah, I just finished, by the way, searching 10 megs of the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, and that all the references to hemp are industrial grade hemp. Jimmy, I gotta move along, but you make a good point, and hemp is one of the most efficient plants when it comes to converting sunlight into fiber or sunlight into oil, and it's far more efficient than trees. So if you, for example, grows very, very rapidly. It's it's like right up there with sawgrass, and hemp is not marijuana. It's a different thing, and I should have searched his writings for marijuana. But in any case, that's a Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara, we have just a minute before I have to take a break. Is this a quick one or? What's up?
It's going to be quicker than that, Tom.
Okay.
There's a truck that is right outside my window, and no matter where I move, I can't get rid of the background noise. So it's quite disturbing. If I may try at another time and let someone else have the benefit of your... It's the background noise is
so
loud.
All righty. No problem, Barbara. Thank you for calling, and thank you for hanging on, though. I appreciate it. Fascinating. See, yes, Thomas Jefferson grew hemp. George Washington grew hemp, all of them grew hemp, and it's so bizarre that keep in mind, hemp does not contain tetrahydrocannabinol, 9-delta-THC, the ingredient that gets you high in marijuana, and marijuana is like a variation, it's a different variety of the plant, let's say, and we really should be considering industrial hemp in the United States. They're growing it in Canada right now. And, you can buy, there's hemp stores in the United States. You can buy hemp soap, hemp clothing and stuff. Most of that's grown in Canada. Some of it's grown overseas. But not here. Why? Well, because it looks like pot. It's absurd. 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Exposing the con in conservative. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Right here, 9 minutes before the hour. On this day in history, in 1984, President Ronald Reagan, during a voice check for a radio broadcast, said...
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Russia was not pleased. Anyhow, that's... And also on this day, equally infamously, Alcatraz was opened and Alan Greenspan became chairman of the Fed. What an odd confluence of events. Here, speaking of odd confluences, or coincidences, or whatever, parallelisms. On the one hand, here we have NBC... Let me frame this first. The question is, to what extent is the United States the tail, and to what extent are we the dog? And if we're the dog, who all is the tail? Okay, so first, the UK. NBC News has learned, I shared this with you earlier, bears repeating, probably over and over and over again, and many of you might have just tuned in recently. NBC News has learned, this is from MSNBC.com, an article by Aram Roston, Lisa Myers in the NBC News Investigative Unit. NBC News has learned that U.S. and British authorities had a significant disagreement over when to move in on the suspects in the alleged plot to bring down transatlantic airliners bound for the United States. A senior British official knowledgeable about the case, said British police were planning to continue to run surveillance for at least another week to try to obtain more evidence, while American officials pressured them to arrest the suspects sooner. The official spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the case. In contrast to previous reports, the official suggested an attack was not imminent, saying the suspects had not yet purchased any airline tickets. In fact, some did not even have passports, which, of course, would be necessary to get on a flight bound for the United States. The source did say, however, that police believed one UK-based suspect was ready to conduct a dry run. British authorities had wanted to let him go forward with part of the plan, but the Americans balked. In other words, we set the timing for the arrest, even though it meant that the British were not able to get a little bit more evidence that they could have been used to actually prosecute these guys in court. So that's one wag. Here's another. This is from Robert Perry. This is over at Consortium News. Robert Perry, old reporter, back to the AP days. Amidst the political and diplomatic fallout from Israel's faltering invasion of Lebanon, writes Robert Perry, some Israeli officials are privately blaming President George W. Bush for egging Prime Minister Ehud Olmert into the ill-conceived military adventure against the Hezbollah militia in South Lebanon. Bush conveyed his strong personal support for the military offensive during a White House meeting with Olmert on May 23rd, according to sources familiar with the thinking of senior Israeli leaders. Olmert, who, like Bush, lacks direct wartime experience, agreed that a dose of military force against Hezbollah might damage the guerrilla group's influence in Lebanon and intimidate its allies, Iran and Syria, countries that Bush has identified as the chief obstacles to U.S. interests in the Middle East. As part of Bush's determination to create a new Middle East, one that is more amenable to U.S. policies and desires, Bush even urged Israel to attack Syria. But the Olmert government refused to go that far, according to Israeli sources. Now, this is from Robert Perry, old-line reporter, writing over at consortiumnews.com. He goes on to note, the Israeli operation was eerily reminiscent of the disastrous U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Like the U.S. assault, Israel relied heavily on shock and awe air power and committed an inadequate number of soldiers to the battle. Israeli newspapers have been filled with complaints from soldiers who say some reservists weren't issued body armor, while other soldiers found their equipment either inferior or inappropriate to the battlefield conditions. Israeli troops also encountered fierce resistance from Hezbollah guerrillas who took a page from the Iraqi insurgents by using explosive booby traps and ambushes to inflict heavier than expected casualties on the Israelis. He continues, again, this is Robert Perry writing over at consortiumnews.com. Back in Israel, some leading newspapers have begun calling for Olmert's resignation. The newspaper Haaretz wrote in a front-page analysis, quote, "If Olmert runs away now from the war he initiated, he will not be able to remain prime minister for even one more day. You cannot lead an entire nation to war promising victory and produce humiliating defeat and remain in power. You cannot bury 120 Israelis in cemeteries, keep a million Israelis in shelters for a month, and say, oops, I made a mistake." End of quote. This from Haaretz. For his part, Robert Perry writes, Bush spent July and August fending off international demands for an immediate ceasefire. Bush wanted to give Olmert as much time as possible to bomb targets across Lebanon and dislodge Hezbollah forces in the south. But instead of turning the Lebanese population against Hezbollah, as Washington and Tel Aviv had hoped, the devastation rallied public support behind Hezbollah. So is it that the Israeli invasion of Lebanon was something that George W. Bush was suggesting to them on May 23rd? Man, that would be tragic. I mean, this is like beyond bizarre. That would be tragic. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, conservative Sam Kasman claims the FDA is moving too slow in approving new drugs. I'll be asking, shouldn't we be more concerned about safety than corporate profits? That and more in your call right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.